United States v. Ward. Ms. Romero.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Romero, and I am a senior law student appearing on behalf... My name is Jessica Romero, and I am a senior law student appearing on behalf of Ashauna Ward, pursuant to Circuit Rule 34H, and under the supervision of Abner Mikva and Mark Hireman. For purposes of clarity, I will be referring to the defendants by first name. I will be focusing on two issues raised in our brief, both which pertain to the introduction of Gregory's alleged adoptive admission against my client. Both these claims still hold, even in the case that this court were to find the admission was properly admitted against Gregory. The first is a Bruton claim, and the second, in the alternative, that the district court failed to instruct the jury not to consider the admission against my client during its deliberation. Ashauna, a young mother of two with no prior criminal record, was convicted as a result of her husband's alleged adoptive admission and received a sentence greater than his at their joint trial. The Confrontation Clause, however, prohibited the introduction of this admission at the joint trial against Ashauna. It constituted inadmissible evidence, inadmissible hearsay. The statement adopted by silence at issue in this case was, "That's the money they got when they robbed the bank where his wife worked." Ashauna was not present at the time this admission was made, and in fact, all three witnesses present at the time of the admission testified they had no contact whatsoever with Ashauna regarding any of the stolen bank robbery proceeds.
Now, Ms. Romero, even if we were to assume that letting Mr. Ward's adoptive admission into evidence was error as to Mrs. Ward, why was it plain error?
We accept the burden of plain error review in this case, if Your Honor, if this court finds that it is the appropriate standard, because under the unique facts of this case, we believe that it survives plain error review for several reasons. First of all, the nature of the violation in this case, Confrontation Clause violation, is one which should draw the particular attention of this court. The introduction of Gregory's admission and at the joint trial clearly had a devastating effect on my client's case. It was the only piece of direct evidence linking Ashauna's conduct the morning of the robbery to the existence of an alleged unlawful agreement before the fact to rob the bank. Ashauna's conduct, however, the morning of the robbery was explained in full during the trial by corporate investigator Angie Taro, who said her conduct was completely consistent with employee training. Ms. Taro also testified that Ms. Ward gave the robber bait bills, which are used to track the location of bank robbery proceeds. The government also
didn't she pass up an opportunity though to give the bills that contain the dimes.
Ashauna was instructed by the robber not to include dye packs. The robber was also at that moment holding Chantel James, the other teller present at the bank that morning at gunpoint.
What was the reason she passed up the opportunity to set off the silent alarms?
As I mentioned, Ms. Ward was following the instructions given to her by the robber that morning while he held her teller and her friend, Chantel James, at gunpoint in the other room. Ms. Taro testified at trial. Her conduct was completely consistent with employee training. You do not play hero when one of the teller's lives are at stake by calling the police and creating a greater confrontation.
Setting off the silent alarm?
That's correct. Ms. Taro testified to this extent at trial.
Now, I'd like to go back to the question of plain error because, aren't there a number of cases such as our opinion in York, which suggests that Bruton's logic doesn't apply to admissions that were made to persons other than law enforcement agents?
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The facts of York were such that there was sufficient reliability with regard to the statements in that case, the declarations against penal interest, which were sufficiently reliable to be admitted at trial, to the point where the value of confrontation in that case would have been a little value. This is not such a case. Ms. Ward did not have the opportunity to cross-examine her co-defendant. He did not take the stand at trial. And furthermore, the adoptive admission was admitted under Federal Rule of Evidence 801, which relies particularly on the adversarial system in order to test its reliability at trial.
How do we know that she's referenced in that statement?
The use of the term they is used twice in the statement, along with describing the location of the bank robbery as the bank where his wife worked. The use of the term they does not sanitize Gregory's admission in this case. While it may seem facially neutral, it is not. As a result, this court's holding in Briscoe is that when the only other alleged participant claims a Bruton violation as a result of the use of a neutral pronoun, there's an inevitable inference that the jury will consider that admission as against both defendants because it refers to them in the plural. In this particular case, the use of the term they, along with a combination of the description of the robbery as the locale of the robbery, as where his wife worked, served as a red flag to the jury to indicate the role of Gregory's accomplice in this case. And there was no question at trial that this was Ms. Ward. At trial, FBI agent Ronald Reddy testified that Ashauna and Gregory were the only two suspects ever investigated by the FBI for this bank robbery. If there are no further questions, I would like
to... What about the circumstances of the discovery, Ms. Romero, of the money and its location in the home?
Yes, Your Honor. The government relies heavily on the fact that bank robbery proceeds were found at the joint Ward residence. This fails to support the substantial inference that the government seeks to draw, which is that Ms. Ward entered into an unlawful agreement before the fact to rob the bank. In Williams, on similar facts, this court found that the wife of a drug dealer, her presence during drug transactions, and in fact even her consumption of drug transactions, did not support her membership in a conspiracy. If there are no further questions at this time,
on that point, don't we have something that is slightly different here? Not only was this not found in a trapdoor, basement, hidden situation, it was in kind of common areas, and you're suggesting she would have been unaware, especially with the bank markings on one bag, that robbery proceeds were kept in her home?
At its very best, Your Honor, this evidence shows that Ashauna may have had knowledge that Gregory was involved with the disposal of bank robbery proceeds, and that she was aware bank robbery proceeds were in fact in her home. These were counts 4 and 5 of the indictment, however, the lesser counts, which she was not convicted of. She was convicted of the greater counts of conspiracy in this case. In the alternative, the district court erred by failing to instruct Ashauna by failing to instruct the jury not to consider Gregory's admission against Ashauna. If there are no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Romero. Mr. Garland. Excuse me, Mr. Leon. I misspoke.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Abel Leon, and I represent the defendant appellant Gregory Ward in this appeal. Your Honors, the district court should never have allowed the jury to hear the adoptive admission testimony by Gardner because the government never established that Gregory Ward actually heard and understood the incriminating statement.
Did either of the defendants ever ask to voir dire Ms. Walker or any other witness to Walker's statement outside the presence of the jury so as to establish that the criteria for the admission of his adoptive admission were satisfied? For example, to establish that he was within earshot of Ms. Walker when she made the statement.
Your Honor, the record does not reflect that Walker was voir dired by the court. However, the court based its decision to allow the testimony simply based on a proffer made by the government as to what Ms. Gardner's testimony was going to be. And he made this determination after Ms. Walker had actually testified. Now,
did either of the defendants make a specific objection that the criteria for admission of her statement and Mr. Ward's response were not satisfied?
Yes, Your Honor. trial attorney, defense attorney, Mr. Tunick, objected several times. The appellate record at 10, 20, and 30 shows that he objected on the basis of hearsay. Which, yes. Additionally, when the trial court made its decision, it had heard the testimony by Walker, which did not include the incriminating statement, and it had heard a conclusory proffer by the government essentially stating that she, referring to Ms. Gardner, will say that Ms. Walker said in defendant's presence, "This is the money from when they robbed the bank." Your Honors, the court never addressed whether Gregory Ward actually ever heard or understood the statement. Instead, it made two fatal assumptions. Number one, that the statement had been made when it clearly was aware that there was some contention between the parties as to whether or not the statement had actually been made by Walker. And it assumed that Gregory heard and understood the statement, rather than try to find out exactly just how close he was or whether or not he was within earshot of Walker. The court focused on why Gregory Ward did not respond to the statement allegedly made by Walker. In fact, his question during the proffer was, well, we need to address whether or not there are two reasons why Gregory Walker would not have responded to this. One is the statement was not true. Second, the statement was true, and therefore it's an adoptive admission. At no point did the court go beyond that. At no point did the court actually take into consideration that maybe Gregory Ward didn't hear the statement. Walker's testimony did not establish any type of indicia as to where the parties were in relation to each other. She simply said they were in a basement apartment.
Was she cross-examined?
Yes. Excuse me. Yes, she was, Your Honor. Yes, she was, but her testimony did not include the incriminating statement because she did not remember saying it, and the court was advised of this, that Walker did not remember having made this particular statement, and the court decided to wait until before Ms. Gardner's testimony.
Leon, even assuming we have error, what about the weight of the evidence in this case against Mr. Gregory?
Your Honor, the reason that this is not harmless error, as the government argues in its brief, is because the evidence against Gregory Ward specifically is very weak. Besides the adoptive admission testimony, which directly implicates him with the bank robbery, we know that the sole testifying eyewitness to the robbery could not identify him as the bank robber, despite the fact that she had seen the robber without a mask before the robbery started. We also know that none of the seven fingerprints recovered at the scene of the robbery matched Gregory Ward's fingerprints. There is a surveillance videotape from the jewel store and for that morning, and it does not contain anyone matching Gregory Ward's description.
How about the clothing that was found? It's pretty similar with the bandana.
That's right, Your Honor. The detective found the bandana, the coat, and a gun that were similar. However, the witness testified that though they were similar, she could not say for certain that these were the ones recovered from the bank robbery.
He's pretty flush with cash, wasn't he?
Say that again, sorry, Your Honor.
He's pretty flush with cash, wasn't he, after the robbery? I mean.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, despite the fact that he did have that he did concede to having bank robbery proceeds, he was convicted for being the bank robber at the actual scene of the crime. Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to reserve 2.5 minutes for my rebuttal.
Surely. Thank you.
All
right. Ms. Gerwin, now you get your chance. I just wanted to see if you were ready, Mr. Gerwin. That's all right.
May it please the Court, Michael Gerwin on behalf of the United States. It's the government's position, Your Honor, that the district court did not abuse its discretion when it allowed the jury to consider the silent admission, which is at the heart of both defendants' appeals.
How do we know that Mr. Ward actually heard Ms. Walker's statement about the robbery, such that we can be reasonably confident that he adopted it?
A number of reasons, Your Honor. First, if you look at the testimony of Kimberly Gardner, the statement that is made, which is the subject of the motion, that's the money they got when they robbed the bank, is said on the heels of defendant Gregory Ward saying, "I want my money. Where's my money?" The evidence shows that he was participating in the conversation. And Deborah Walker's sister is also, the evidence shows, said, after she said, that's the money we got when they robbed the bank, she said, I can't believe he's going to jail for 10 years for something he doesn't have. And the defendant further incriminates himself.
Yeah, but here's what I need answered. Wasn't the government at least obliged to establish that Mr. Ward was within earshot of Ms. Walker when she made the statement that he purportedly adopted by his silence?
Yes, and I believe there are sufficient foundational facts for the judge and for the jury to have concluded that. Specifically, both of the defendants who testified about the critical conversation testified consistently that it took place in the same area. One describes it as a kitchen area. The other one describes it as a kitchen bathroom area. It's true that the dimensions of the room are not contained in the record, but the conversations each witness describes show a give and take. They show that the defendant is participating in that conversation. He makes the statement at the end of the conversation, something's got to give or else I'm going to catch a murder before I go back to jail. That echoes his sister's comment. It shows that he heard what she was saying. It also further incriminates himself along the line. But more importantly, it shows that his silence was significant. It shows that he was participating in the conversation. The witnesses also testified consistently that the defendant made this statement after he was told he couldn't have his money and after he became upset. And I think Judge Kaur hit the nail on the head when he said in his ruling that he was going to admit or allow the jury to consider this testimony in part because the money was unaccounted for and the defendant was agitated. And I believe what the judge was saying was Gregory Ward had $50,000 worth of reasons to pay attention to what people were saying, just as he wanted to be heard by them in that kitchen area when he made his threat. So I do think there was sufficient foundation in the record to show that there was a give and take, that he was in a confined space, and that he did hear what other people were saying, and that he intended to be heard in that conversation. Also, because Judge Kaur instructed the jury that they could consider the adopted admission if and only if they first found that the defendant was present for, heard, and understood the admission, and if and only if they first found that he would have denied it if it weren't true, there cannot be any unfair harm to defendant Gregory Ward. This issue is a jury issue. It's a question of a limited admissibility, and I believe the district court properly handled that issue after hearing Sephora Walker's testimony and after hearing the proffer by handing the fact-intensive issue to the jury. There's also, finally, with regard to defendant Ward, sufficient evidence in the record to show that the statement was in fact true. When he gave the $50,000 to his sister, Sephora Walker, in the first instance, she asked him where he got it from. He said it doesn't matter. And the other evidence in the case shows, in fact, that he did obtain that money from a bank robbery. With regard to Ashauna Ward, it's the government's position that there was no error in not giving a limiting instruction. And the reason is because the statement they, the neutral pronoun they, is ambiguous as to Ashauna Ward. There's no indication from the face of the statement who it's referring to. And I submit that this is one of those instances, because of the ambiguity of the statement, where if the defense attorney wanted a statement in his trial strategy, if he wanted a limiting instruction, he should have asked for one. And under the evidentiary rules, Rule 105, the judge is supposed to give an instruction upon request. Well, there was no request. I think the evidence shows that there was no request because no one considered that this statement was going to be used against her. It wasn't used against her at trial. No argument was made.
Who else would they have included other than Mrs. Ward?
Well, there's only one person who comes into the bank to rob the bank. So from the description of the bank robbery given by Ashauna Ward, they should refer to a single person. The fact that there are two defendants doesn't necessarily mean that they is referring to the other defendant. The statement is made amongst four people. Ashauna Ward is not present when the statement is made. And it's neutral. And I actually think that if you look at...
So it's a matter of grammar, you know, they were bad grammarians? Is that...
It's a matter of the statement being unspecific and being unclear. And I think if you look at Ashana Ward's reply brief, if you look at page, I think it's page 18 of their brief, there's a very similar statement in a trial where the defendant refers to a she. And appellants argue that she absolutely cannot refer to Ashana Ward. It's ambiguous. It's unclear. This is exactly the same type of statement.
Well,
it doesn't facially incriminate
her. There's a little bit of a difference between she and they.
She may be more specific than they.
It's an unusual argument, but fine. Let's talk about the enhancement for abduction just for a minute. She argues that there's no evidence that she knew her husband would use a gun, so that it's unlikely that she would have then known, or rather foreseen, his abduction of Ms. James. So what evidence would support the inference that she knew about the gun?
A number of things. First of all, the gun box and gun receipts were found in their home, along with the $28,000 wrapped in Federal Reserve wrappers and the other money. So there is evidence in the record that she knew that her husband owned a gun. More significantly, given the nature of this crime, this is an unusual situation because this is an inside job at a bank committed between a husband and wife. There is a great deal of knowledge on her part, which I think shows that she's actually the one who orchestrated the bank robbery. She knew that there was going to be someone else present that morning, and she knew that that person was going to need to be restrained in order to give her the time, the 5 to 10 minutes that she took to go into the vault, out of eyesight of anyone, stuff $209,000 in a bag, which took her some time, avoid pressing any alarms, avoid grabbing a dye pack, finding the correct videotape amongst all the videotapes. She needed to make sure that Chantal James, who had to be there to help her open the vault, was going to be restrained. And I would say that evidence, coupled with the obvious fact that they're a husband and wife, coupled with the fact that they lived together and there was evidence of the gun obtained from their home, suggests not only that she knew, but that she herself was responsible for taking the steps necessary to have Chantal James restrained and abducted.
Did you agree that the government's witness, I gather it was a government witness, testified that her conduct was consistent with someone who was being robbed?
No, I don't agree with that at all. That was there was a statement brought out on cross-examination regarding the bay bills, and the fact that giving bay bills would be something you would do. Obviously, Ashana Ward would know that giving bay bills, as opposed to giving a dye pack, would not cause smoke and red dye to spray over her husband if he walked out of the bank. She knew what alarms, what buttons not to press. So I don't believe that it's consistent. In fact, when Chantal James leaves the bank with a gun at her back, she doesn't do what anyone would have done, which is call the police. Those silent alarms exist for a reason, and she didn't push them for a reason. So I think that the record, the full record and the full testimony of the bank detective shows that, for the most part, she did not do what she was taught to do.
If we assumed that she didn't know about the gun, why would it have been reasonably foreseeable to her that an abduction might occur, given how few bank robberies involve abductions?
And my reason is similar to the reason that I gave you before. I don't think it's right to look at this bank robbery in the same light that you look at all bank robberies, because it's an inside job and because it's between a husband and a wife, and because when she closed the bank the night before the robbery, she knew that Chantal James had to be there with her, and she knew that something had to be done, as probation found, and I'm referring to that because the judge specifically relied upon probation's finding in the pre-sentence report that her abduction was necessary for the getaway, as well as the other elements of the crime that I described.
Just as an aside, is it correct that she had only worked for this bank for 3 weeks?
Yeah, she had worked at a bank prior to working at this bank, which is why she was able to have a more senior position.
Ah.
If there are no further questions, I would ask simply that this court affirm the conviction and sentence to the district court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ferlin. Ms. Romero.
Two brief points in rebuttal. The first is, the record indicates the abduction was not necessary in order for the robber to exit the bank successfully. And second, unlike York, Your Honor, this is not a case where the silent nature of the admission would not have rendered the right of confrontation and cross-examination in this case of little value. York involved numeral verbal assertions against penal interest, which involved both defendants. Finally, it is a miscarriage of justice in this case to allow the prosecution to benefit from the introduction of a statement that they should not have received any benefit from. Finally, if there are no further questions, for those reasons and the reasons set forth in our brief, we ask you reverse Ashana's conviction and alternatively remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Romero. Ms. Leon.
Just a few brief points, Your Honors. The government misstates the testimony when it says that the testimony clearly showed that the parties were all within the same room at the time the court made its decision, which is a pivotal time for purposes of making the determination. We had the testimony from Walker, which said that they were around the kitchen, bathroom area.
Does the record reflect at all the general size of the apartment?
No, Your Honor. In fact, all we knew when Walker was asked for a description of the apartment, she said it was a basement apartment. The government, in its brief, cites three different cases for the proposition that there was sufficient evidence here for an adoptive admission. However, in all those three cases, Tedder, Andrews, and Aponte, the court specifically had evidence which stated the proximity and location of the parties to each other. Tedder, the defendant was within earshot. In Andrews, the defendant was sitting around a table when the statement was made. And in Aponte, the defendant was in one hotel room next to the people who made the statement. There was no such finding ever made in this case. Your Honors, as you know, an adoptive admission is an exception to the hearsay rule because of the presumptive reliability and the telling nature of silence in the face of a statement which incriminates a defendant. Because of that reason, a trial court has an obligation to make a preliminary finding that the defendant actually heard and understood the incriminating statement before allowing a jury to hear such damaging evidence. In this case, the district court failed to do that, and for that reason, we ask that this court reverse the decision, reverse his conviction, and in the alternative, grant him a new trial.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. I want to offer a special thanks to Ms. Romero, to you, and to the law school for accepting the appointment. And Mr. Leon, a special thanks to you and your law firm for supporting the pro bono effort and accepting the appointment in this case, and to both of you for ably representing the appellant. Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement.